Now you are. All right. How's that for level? Is that too loud for the level? Perfect? Okay. Well, I don't particularly care about it. No, I won't say who it is. That's the other one. That's right. You're the man. That interest in the world and travel
is near each other in Chicago. And I remember one time somebody said that China was right under Chicago.
I remember that too. In fact, I also remember that we immediately proceeded to dig up the backyard in search of it. Well, now, needless to say, China wasn't reached that time. Although some years later it was.
Only not via the backyard. Lisa, being a singer, had a singing engagement in Paris and asked me if I'd like to go along. Well, the answer was yes, as I had always wanted to go to Europe.
Me too, except when I got there, of all things that could possibly happen to anyone, my job fell through.
You've never seen a more dejected person than Lisa. Her first thought was to turn around and go right back home. But my thought, now that I had finally gotten there, was to stay a while.
Then Jean had a brilliant idea. She thought it was very silly for me to go home so soon, and being an actress, she decided that although the role might not be easy, she would act as my manager and try to get me work. Well, I certainly didn't think she could, and you know, I really don't think she did either. But she did, and before long, engagements were all over Europe and finally all around the world.
And all this time, the cameras were going at a fast and furious pace. Everything was photographed, from the Eiffel Tower to wild monkeys in India, to chop suey in China.
You know, there never was time to check to see if Chicago really were under China.
Then, arriving back in the United States, which turned out to be 3 years later, we found we had more interesting film than anything else.
And that's when we decided to go back and make a picture of just one of the many countries visited. And that's the one you're going to see this evening, Austria.
Now, in case you're wondering how two people are going to narrate one film, that's easily solved. I'm leaving.
But she'll be back to take you on the second half of the trip. And now if your bags are packed and your pockets full, we'll start. But first, just a word about Austria. As you know, it was once the most rich, powerful empire, encompassing almost 116,000 square miles. Well, now it's shrunk to a size smaller than the state of Maine. But still, the warm spirit of its 7 million people has remained as expansive as ever. Austria lies in Central Europe and is surrounded by six countries. To the west is Switzerland, to the north, Germany and Czechoslovakia, to the east lies Hungary, and to the south are Yugoslavia and Italy. And it's divided into nine provinces, which are very similar to our states. But rather than say any more about Austria, I think the Austrians themselves best sum it up. They hope heaven will be just like Austria. So now, if we can have the lights, please, we'll see just how heavenly Austria is. The day we left New York for Austria, we both felt great anticipation crossing the field of the waiting plane. But this we didn't anticipate. Now, just what does one do at a time like this? Luckily, a man from the airlines rushed in and gallantly helped pick up all the odd assortment of things that we women are guilty of carrying. And miraculously, he got them all back in that little bag. I'm afraid we delayed the flight a bit, though, and being the last ones on, stumbled up the stairs as quickly as possible. We thought we were traveling light. But it's all Jean could do to get up the stairs at all with just what she was carrying. It's good there's a railing there to catch her. At last, safely in. Stairs away and we're away. Our competent pilot jetted us smoothly over the clouds, and before we knew it, we were in Frankfurt, Germany, a mere 8 hours later. None the worse for wear, and ready to go on up north to Wolfsburg to pick up our car that was to take us on to Austria. Wolfsburg is a modern, thriving town where the world-popular Volkswagen is made. In fact, the entire reason for and livelihood of the town is the manufacturing of the little car. In the mile-long factory, that's the long brown building in the distance, they turn out over 3,000 cars a day. And it's here we picked up our shiny red wagon, which was to be a faithful companion on the ensuing journey. The population of the town is 60,000, and over 30,000 are employed here at the plant, which is quite a percentage. Their high wages have made Wolfsburg one of the most prosperous young towns in Germany. And from the looks of the employees' parking lot, you can see they believe in the product they manufacture. Don't you wonder how they managed to find their own car? Just 5 miles east of the bustling town is the bleak, forbidding border between East and West Germany. Armed guards are on either side, although you can't see them on the eastern side as they stay well hidden from sight in dugouts. It's hard to realize that this was once the busy main road to Leipzig, now overgrown and deserted. It's amazing what a change there can be in so short a distance. Back in Wolfsburg, everything's new, shining, and modern. The public buildings, schools, and churches all reflect the West and progress. The apartment buildings are colorfully decorated, and there's even an apartment building for the unmarried Volkswagen employees called the Bachelor House. And this bachelor must be trying to attract a wife. Quite a new technique, glancing the sun off a mirror. The only thing that has any age here is the old 14th century Castle Wolfsburg, from which the town derives its name. It was owned by one family for over 500 years, but since the war it's become a home for the little refugee children from East Germany. On Sundays, families gather in their gardens to spend typical weekend days. They're proud to say how there are more children and cars in Wolfsburg than any other town in Europe for its size. And here, naturally, even the children have Volkswagens. Some might even be candy-coated. Soon, we were in our own little red wagon, slightly larger, though, and it was a happy day when it carried us across the border into Austria. We headed right for Vienna, following the Danube along its most scenic and legendary portion called the Wachau. The sleepy river village of Dürnstein gets its name from the castle ruins above the town, where Richard the Lionhearted was imprisoned when returning home from the Crusades. And springtime richly patterns the fields with scarlet poppies. Danube steamers leisurely make excursions up and down the romantic river, stopping all along the way at the towns and villages. And gaily decorated little boats line the banks at Melk, the most important town of this region because of its majestic abbey, the largest of its kind in the world. The end of spring in Melk brings a Sonnenfest, the festival to welcome in summer. And on the mountaintops along the river, fires are built, figures are burned, and the sight and sound of fireworks fill the last night of spring. You might say this little figure's literally blowing his top over it all. What a grand prelude these fireworks are. Not only the summer, but also Vienna. For Vienna's not just the name of a city. It's joy, gaiety, a way of life. Vienna's the Danube, Johann Strauss and his waltzing woods. Its fabulous variety of entertainments have brought visitors to it from all parts of the world throughout the centuries. It's the home of artists, poets, writers, and above all, some of the world's greatest music was born here. Beethoven, who lived here, found his source of inspiration in its creative atmosphere. Vienna, what you might call the concert stage and the pleasure stage of the world. This is Helena, a young music student of typical Viennese beauty. She's copping down the musical event she wants to hear performed during the festival weeks, and these colorful kiosks all over town announce the varied programs being presented, such as operas, symphonies, oratorios, and chamber works. Going through the rose-laden Volksgarten, the oldest park in Vienna, Helene is on her way to the music academy, as she's a very serious piano student. She passes the Votive Church, built in gratitude for the preservation of the life of Emperor Franz Joseph. In 1853, on this very spot, an assassin attempted to take the life of the young monarch, but luckily failed. Entering the famed Music Academy, Helene hopes she too will become as fine an artist as the many it has produced. Some afternoon, she goes out to study her music in the quiet gardens of the magnificent Schönbrunn Palace. It was mainly the creation of Empress Maria Theresa during the 18th century and was her favorite summer residence. The mellow color of its exteriors even called Maria Theresa yellow. And many famous personages through the past lived in this Versailles of Vienna. Marie Antoinette was born here. Napoleon occupied its royal rooms. His ill-fated son, the Duke of Reichstag, died here. And the most beloved of the ruling monarchs, Emperor Franz Joseph, was born and died here. The palace derives its name, Schönbrunn, meaning beautiful fountain, from those found throughout the grounds. And musical history was made here too, when little 5-year-old Mozart amazed the court with his virtuosity in playing the harpsichord. After his performance, he tripped and fell down, and young Marie Antoinette helped him up. He thanked her, saying, "I will marry you." She no doubt wished he had, instead of losing her head to a Frenchman. Across the city, Helena suggested we meet to take a carriage ride by the famed opera house, adorned with festival flags. And this is where all Vienna met in November 1955 when its doors reopened. Destroyed by the last war, the work and spirit of the people rebuilt it as it stood before. A decade of foreign occupation had ceased, and with the performance of Beethoven's Fidelio that memorable night, Vienna came back to life. Already now in the carriage, and our cheery little driver doffs his hat as we leave for the Ringstrasse. Franz Joseph converted the original city walls, which circled old Vienna, into this beautiful boulevard, lined with many gardens and important public buildings, such as Parliament, fronted by an impressive statue of Athena. The Art History Museum houses many priceless works of art, and the statue of Maria Theresa overlooks the museum. With all the pressing affairs of state during her 40-year reign, she had 16 children. And present-day mothers think they're busy? The Karlskirche, one of the leading churches, is considered the finest example of Baroque art in Europe. It's the masterpiece of the architect Fischer von Erlach, whose name one finds throughout the country. And right next door is the house where the composer Franz Schubert lived. And here he composed some of his loveliest songs. Our driver, whose name was Wilhelm Walter von Achuber, we called him Willie, delighted in pointing out the beauty of the Viennese architecture as we rode around. And coming into the busy Albertina Platz, the first thing one sees is the Café Mozart, where everyone gathers for a snack. Well, being ready for one ourselves, we headed for the garden restaurant in the Stadtpark, where concerts accompany calories. When we arrived there, the wonderful summer day combined with the gaiety of the music had captured everyone's fancy, especially this tiny budding conductor. The pastry tray, a Viennese specialty, was brought to us laden with Sachertorte, Kuchen mit Schlag, that's cakes with whipped cream. Well, if any of you are diet conscious, this is the time to close your eyes. I didn't, and have been on a diet ever since. In the meantime, while Willie waited for us, he gave his horses their form of pastry, too. Only wouldn't you say served in a slightly different manner? And no pastry's complete without another Viennese specialty, their coffee. Mit Schlag, of course. Vienna introduced coffee to the Western world, having gotten it from the Turks during one of their sieges on the city. And the popular coffee houses that we find everywhere originated here, too. Well, if our horses keep this up much longer, they may have to go on a diet, too, as does everyone who goes to Vienna. Ah, so, Unterbahn plays on, and so does the little conductor. Notice here his feeling for the waltz. He just might be a future Strauss. We were on our way again to see the statues of the great composers who lived in Vienna. Mozart, a unique, prolific composer, but he died a pauper in Vienna. Haydn, who laid the foundation for the modern symphony, and Brahms, the godfather of many modern composers, the mighty Beethoven. Schubert, the prince of songs, writing over 600. Bruckner, a great organist, famed for his symphonies, and Vienna isn't complete without Johann Strauss, who set the entire world a-waltzing. The theater plays a very important part in the life of Vienna, too. And the Burg Theater, begun in 1776 by Joseph II, became famous for its grandeur of tragic drama. Seats were handed down through the generations from one courtier to another like family jewels. You know, traffic seems to be the same just about everywhere. But in Vienna, it's one man's joy. He's known and loved as the happy policeman. Smiling and waving at everyone, he's become a symbol of their lightheartedness. His ambition is to always be at this corner on the ring and to have a pretty Viennese wife. I think our ambition is to have just a few more policemen like him over here. Across the Heldenplatz, meaning Heroes Square, you can see the Rathaus or courthouse with its Gothic towers. And going through the Michaela Rotunda, where the Hofburg is located, we pass under the beautiful wrought iron Michaela Gate. The Hofburg is the imperial palace and was a favorite residence of the Habsburg emperors from 1282 right down to 1918. And today the royal apartments are used by the president of Austria. Also, the Imperial Spanish Riding School is here. And it's a common sight to see the famed horses crossing the busy street to go into their arena. The magnificent hall is another example of architect Fischer von Erlach's artistry. For over 200 years, these majestic horses have classically demonstrated the traditional high school of equitation. The skill of horse and rider blend as one in a harmony of movement. Their intricate steps, paces, and jumps are executed with flawless ease and grace. Their breeding farm is in the village of Pieber, about 140 miles south of Vienna, and here they're raised and trained. The Lipizzaner horses, as they are also called, were first bred in Lipizza, a village near Trieste, which was then a part of Austria, in 1508. They're of three-quarter Spanish stock and one-quarter Arabic, and their snow whiteness is most interesting when you realize they're born black. The mares with their foals are found grazing in the low meadows, and here you can see the babies with the first hint of white breaking through their dark coats. While high up on the isolated mountain slopes, the young stallions, color still changing, roam. Their performing life is certainly a long one, starting at the age of four and reaching their peak of perfection in their middle 30s. Back in Vienna, the lights of the crystal chandeliers come up, and the regal performance commences.
Thank you.
entertainment is the Riesenrad or Ferris wheel. Here, Helena likes to go with her beau Heinrich on her day away from the piano. The amusement park is in the large area of the Volksprater, which was originally the hunting grounds for royalty. But since being opened to the public by Joseph II, it's become a favorite recreation place for the Viennese. And incidentally, since this day, we got a letter from Helena saying that she and Heinrich are now happily married. The giant wheel, said to be the largest in the world, those little red cars hold 30 people, lifts crowds 24 stories up into the sky and leisurely takes a quarter of an hour to circle around, giving one plenty of time to enjoy the panorama of the city below. It's little wonder that Vienna has through the centuries been like a magnet, attracting the learned, the pleasure-seeking, and the creative people of the world. There are few cities as rich in such a fabulous history and so filled with noble names. Its story is timeless, with its culture touching all shores and its music filling all hearts. Vienna's not complete without their beloved choir boys, so we headed for their summer retreat far off the beaten track in a beautiful valley of the East Tyrol to the tiny hamlet of Hiederbichl. They have their own hotel here for the lucky tourists who managed to find it, called the Wiener Sängerknaben, which means Vienna choir boys. And can you imagine more of a utopia? A room, three meals, plus being able to hear the boys sing in this setting, all for $3 a day. For two. They start their day bright and early with exercises. There are three different groups of choir boys, and in the summer they rotate, so that two are here while one remains in Vienna. After breakfast, their choir master, Professor Grossman, works with one of the groups. The choir boys are one of the oldest musical institutions of Vienna, founded by Maximilian I in 1498, and aside from short disbandments during the World Wars, they've been going ever since. They range in age from 8 to 14 and are chosen from all parts of the country, and more for their innate musical sense and good ear than just good voices. Now the second group is rehearsing with a young director who was trained by Professor Grossman, and these are the very boys who toured here in the United States. Here they're practicing an old Austrian hunting song. Is over, and now as all boys, they're anxious to play. Yearly, the boys appear in concerts throughout the world, and in Vienna, along with their traditional singing Sunday Mass at the Hofburg Chapel, they perform at the state opera, in films, at festive occasions, and they're certainly a cherished part of the Viennese musical life. After lunch, they hike up a mountain path to a clearing for more games and play. They're always under the watchful eye, or, as here, on the shoulders of older boys who were once choir boys themselves. Many have gone on to great positions in the musical world and become famous conductors and composers, such as Haydn, Schubert, and Bruckner, just to name a few. Well, here, I'm afraid it looks like they're getting ready for their American tour. It's a sad day when their voices change and they can no longer be a member of the celebrated group, but they're not dismissed, but instead can remain for as many years as they had spent singing. They do chores, such as giving a muchly needed bath to the car, take care of the younger boys, and help run the hotel, aside from being able to pursue their studies and complete their higher education. The performing choir boys' only duty in the summer is to sing, rest, and play. or as here, wander off to explore the beautiful countryside. Little Hans watched, must say it's time for their talk with Professor Grossman, who gives several hours a day to individual instruction. So off they go to meet him. Professor Grossman not only wants them to know the music, but also to understand its spiritual meaning, so tells them the biblical stories connected with it. Here, too, he's going over their parts of Schubert's Serenade. Twice a week in the evenings, the little boys in their familiar sailor suits perform for the guests of the hotel. With crystal clear voices and lively charm, they've won the hearts of music lovers everywhere. Choir boys in the province of Carinthia is the wonderfully picturesque village of Heiligenblut with the dazzling white Großglockner, Austria's highest mountain towering above it. Heiligenblut is where Friedel Dahmeth, Austria's leading mountain climbing guide, lives, but in the summer he's up at the Franz Josef House where the actual climbing of the mountain begins. We started up the Großglockner highway in search of Herr Dahmeth, and it's one of the most famous mountain roads in Europe, considered an engineering feat. High up at the very top, we found the one hotel, the Franz Josef House. It's perched boldly on a rocky ledge and dramatically overlooks the Peterchen Glacier. Here, too, we found Dahmeth, who started telling us the wonders of climbing the Großglockner. We explained we'd only come to take pictures of him. But this, to the famous climber, seemed impossible to believe, and before we knew it, he was showing us all the equipment we would be using on the climb. Although we both assured him we would not be needing it. Undaunted, he asked when he could bring us the proper clothes for the climb. Again, we told him that mountain climbing was the last thing that either of us would ever attempt, so we would never, never get into such clothes. Never say never. Dahmeth said it'd be a wonderful experience going to the top, but he could see that we were still a bit dubious. So I guess in order to make us feel a little better, he said in all seriousness, "It's not difficult, just dangerous." Well, with such reassuring words, he gave us our picks and helped us on with our packs. Then he explained our route on the map, pointing out the various rest stations or shelters along the way. The time had come to leave the Franz Josef House. Dahmeth makes this climb 2 and 3 times a week and has been doing it for over 20 years. So our first destination, the glacier, which was a 5-mile hike down, not up, was, as he said, absolutely nothing. But with 10-pound packs on our backs and those enormous heavy boots weighting us down, we felt differently about it. Being complete novices, he said we must have a party of at least 3 men to ensure a safer trip. So we stopped at the first rest station en route to the glacier to pick up 2 expert climbers from Denmark, Eric and Sven. After the introductions, the men talked of their adventures on previous climbs, while we got our second wind. Then Sven pointed up to the over 12,000-foot peak, which was beginning to look more ominous than ever. Finally, we were picking our way across the vast Peterchen Glacier, one of the oldest and largest in Europe. In the summer, it appears gray and unimpressive. Still, its innocent-looking cracks and deep, icy crevices are a dangerous threat. It didn't take us long to find the best use for the picks, though not too comfortable. We were so weary by now and too concerned over it steadily getting darker because of the storm clouds gathering down on the glacier. Dahmeth was far more concerned with explaining that there were more uses for the picks than just seats, but I'm afraid he wasn't much influence. The men showed us an easy way to get down a snow embankment. This was definitely not for us. Hanging onto each other, we cautiously started up an ice ledge when Damith encouragingly said, "It's easy as falling off a log." That did it. Jean and I knew we'd never be mountain climbers, and with it looking like the storm would break at any minute, we told Damith and the others to go on, but without us. Then we hastily turned back, only too happy not to be going on, and to get away from that dark glacier. The best climb we could ever hope to make was up the steps to the hotel. After such a strenuous experience, the best place to recuperate would be down to Bad Gastein, one of the leading health resorts of Europe, nestled in the Gastein Valley. Due to its curative waters, people from all over the world have been coming here since the 15th century. The waters remain the same, although there are now over 100 hotels, each with their own thermal baths. The big hotels leap up at you from all sides, and it's a most unexpected sight to come upon in provincial Austria. The healing water is the most highly radioactive water in the world, and in the center of town, the falls plunge right between the luxurious hotels with a deafening roar. This is one place where traffic sounds or school bells won't disturb you. Aside from the baths, which must be taken under medical supervision, you can also drink the mineral water, which is most invigorating. In fact, so much so that after just a few bottles of it, the maps were once again out, and plans were being made to go on to the town of Meierhofen, which lies in the Zillertal Valley and is considered one of the most beautiful valleys in all the Tyrol. Aside from the winding road, one can reach Meierhofen by this miniature gauge railway. It looks like it's right out of a Toonerville cartoon. The slender spire of the church dominates the village scene, and at its foot lies the town square, which is the center of activity. Because of its charm and beauty, many tourists converge on Meierhofen to take various hikes and mountain climbs, as this is a very popular pastime with the Austrians. Students, too, come here for summer courses conducted by the University of Innsbruck. Meierhofen is also renowned for a family of famous woodcarvers, the Marauders. This handicraft has been handed down from generation to generation for over 150 years. Here, the father and his sons are on the porch of their house, busily working at their trade. Otto Marauder, the father, was one of 14 children, seven of whom became woodcarvers, and he has in turn taught his sons. Carl is the youngest. Johann, the second Marauder son, and tall, bearded Alban is the eldest son. And here's the youngest member, fast learning the family skill, little three-year-old Patrick. He's Alban's son. Carl's specialty is carving small figures which are for sale in the Marauder Gallery, located right in their house. Johann does mainly animals. Here he's working on a chamois, and using a soft wood, he's able to make 15 to 20 of these a day. Alban is different than the others, including preceding generations, as he is a modern sculptor of wood. His slender Madonna has the strength and clarity of contemporary design. And our story now centers on Alban and his father, Otto. With the larger model on the left, Otto's now starting to carve his Madonna. And right before your eyes, within the next few minutes, you'll see this solid block of lifeless wood transformed into a flowing, graceful figure that will live for a long time. Here on the river that skirts Meierhofen, Alban searches for unusual driftwood. Although taught by his father in the traditional school of carving, he began to feel that each piece of wood has a special rhythm and tension of its own. And rather than put life into wood, as his father does, he searches for the life and expression already within it and brings it out. As driftwood has the most varied forms, he can envision, as you can see with this piece, the form about to emerge. Aside Aside from driftwood, Alban seeks in all wood, rhythm and grain, and natural flow of line. He begins on a large sculpture by first drawing what the waiting wood has brought to mind. From this sketch, he works with clay, molding it onto a wire. And from the clay model, he carves in soft wood a small figure which serves as the model for his large figure, this time of a Madonna. When he first became interested in modern work, it came as a great shock to his father. He said, "Why, you'll spoil our name. I'll burn our house down before I let you exhibit it." But after 5 years and much work, Alban finally won. And now his father sees the beauty of his son's work as all can in this finished piece. Otto's still busily working, his Madonna being in the classical vein, and it's readily seen, even in the process of being carved, the vast difference in the father and son's style. This Tyrolean hand-painted chest has been in the Marauder family for 200 years, and in it, Otto keeps all of the many figures he has done of his family. This small bust seems to hold many fond memories for Otto, being of his son Alban, long before a whisker bedecked his perky little face. Another in the chest of memories is of his wife, Frau Marauder, holding their infant son Johann. She too enjoys reminiscing and joins him to look at their form of a family photograph album. With the Marauders, one could call it the family wood album. This wonderfully expressive face is a carving of Frau Marauder's mother, and the family resemblance, as you can see, is really remarkable. As this Paris poster indicates, Alban has taken many of his works to be exhibited in European capitals. Among them were Mother and Child, done in two different woods. Looking down on the seated woman was carved out of the trunk of a pine tree. Man in Chair was done out of only one piece of wood. And the severity and simplicity of Alban's flute player contrasts once again with the delicacy and lifelikeness of his father's flute player. And if any of these figures strike the tourist's fancy, some are of a size that can be easily put in your pocket and taken home. Otto's carved picture, Dancing on the Alpine, hangs in the leading hotel, while his nativity can be seen in the town church. It came as quite a surprise to find that Alban, aside from wood carving, has a rich bass voice, and for 6 years has been a member of the most famous of the Tyrol's folk singing groups, the Zillertaler Yodel Quartet. They appear on radio, make records, and tour Europe yodeling their local songs. Alban doesn't have to be away from his workbench very long to find his little son industriously following in the family footsteps. Encouragement's always given, and Patrick proudly possesses a bandaged finger, the badge of the novice. Asked what he's carving, he answers, "Money." Well, that's one way to make money, and a pretty easy one at that. Caught in the act, Patrick sheepishly grins, hiding behind his mallet, then accepts the explanation that this just isn't done, with a most resigned attitude. The final chips of wood are blown from Otto's Madonna, and it stands ready now for its flowing robes to take color. With a fine brush and delicately shaded watercolors, it nears its completion. But the Marauder story is far from its final chapter. Now, whether Patrick will follow in the modern footsteps of his father or in the classical of his grandfather will be unknown for some time, but one can be sure that he too will train his sons in the Marauder wood carving tradition. Otto's finished piece speaks expressively for itself. With the display of the family's works, Patrick felt left out without his being shown, too. And, of course, it had to have a title, too. It's titled Patrick's Mint. With some wonderful wood carvings, we left Meyerhofen and went south to the province of Styria and its capital, Graz. Graz is the second largest city in Austria with a population near a quarter of a million. But it's far less visited by tourists than its lovely setting and cultural activities would merit. The old clock tower, the emblem of Graz, is high up on the castle hill that overlooks the sprawling city that spreads out impressively to the Styrian countryside. Here, we heard of an unusual festival that was taking place in a remote Styrian village called Oberzeiring. Parades, floats, and groups of people from all the neighboring villages were coming to the gaily decorated Oberzeiring to celebrate. The festival is held in honor of the miners, who used to go down to the hazardous mines for silver as long as 500 years ago. Well, the mines have long since been exhausted and closed, but still, every 3 years, the people continue to have their festival, which includes activities pertaining to mining and many others pertaining to nothing but fun. These men are parading to the entrance of the old mine to reenact the ceremony of opening it with the keys and going down into it just as they did back in the 15th century. The words Glukov over the door mean good luck, which I'm sure they need going down into that old mine. They asked us if we'd like to come along too, but remembering our mountain climbing episode, we said nein, Dankeschön. Now, in the traditional miner's costumes, these men perform one of the old miner's dances. Things are going on all over the village. One of their favorite games is this, called Patslin, or in English, just plain finger slapping. I can certainly think of a more enjoyable way to have a good time. The sore-fingered but happy winner. Meanwhile, back on the stage, another miner's dance is taking place. In ancient times, the miners, as an honor, were given the right to carry weapons, and they celebrated the privilege with this weird sword dance. Another game to test the strength and endurance of the strong men of the village. Now they pull on each other's fingers until a mighty champion emerges. In Austria, they certainly must have strong, sore fingers. By the end of the festive day, even the balloons had joined in for some dancing. And after all the excitement of the festival, we found a peaceful, quiet inn in one of the most beautiful settings possible. This is just outside the town of Kitzbühel, which you'll see later on in the film. Also on the outskirts is this 400-year-old house. This is, without a doubt, one of the most beautiful of the typical Tyrolean houses. And it's here that Joseph Ihnfeld, a well-known wrought iron artisan, lives and works. To the left of his door in wrought iron is his name and occupation, Joseph Ihnfeld, Kuntzschmidt. Early every morning, he goes from one section of his house where he lives with his family to the other where his workshop is. And here, the steady sound of his hammer can be heard all day long and has been for some time, as he's proud to say how he's been doing this work for over 65 years. He explains some of the steps in making his pieces. First, the fire, where he softens the iron. Don't you wonder how he manages to keep that long beard working so close to the fire? Then the shaping, with a hammer, later by machine, its power really smoothing it out. The blowtorch is applied to make the paint adhere permanently, and it also makes it stainless. Later on, he brings out the completed pieces, which are now for sale. They range from crosses for the church, stove fronts, electric light fixtures, lanterns, and numerous small articles, too. He's also commissioned by some of the leading churches to make wrought iron gates and doors for them. In fact, one of his doors is in the St. Plausius Church in Salzburg. Aside from doing fine work, Herr Ihnfeld, who's 75 years old, is one of the kindest, most wonderful people. He loves his church, his family, and his big black dog, who's always by his side, and who he calls Whitey. His wife is also an artisan, and her name in wrought iron is to the right side of the door. Anna Burgel, her maiden name, Hutmacherin. She's one of the few people left who still make these traditional costume hats worn by the country people. This is an art all its own, which unfortunately is fast fading out. The exquisite embroidery work on the brim, made with real gold thread, takes 2 weeks to do, and the hats cost about $40. And inside of each is her name, Anna Ihnfeld, and where she's from, Kitzbühel. And now you're going to see them being worn in one of the provincial towns. You know how we women are always being teased by the men over our hats? I just wonder what they'd say if we wore some of these. Now, just in case the men are beginning to feel a little too smug, let's take a look at their hats. In Austria, it's the men who are bedecked with flowers, fresh-cut flowers. How would you like to have this in front of you at the theater? Or this? And I doubt if we'd ever see a gas attendant over here with this on his head. Well, with all these people putting on the dog, in Austria, you're liable to find anything. Thank you very much. And now, after the intermission, Jean Porterfield will be back to take you on the second half of the trip. And this is where it gets very cold and snowy. So this is the time to bundle up.
Examples of egg-laying mammals to be found in the entire world. And the duck-billed platypus is the missing link. He is the missing link between cold-blooded reptiles and warm-blooded mammals, discovered for the first time in a backwater of the Hawkesbury River at the end of the 18th century. This one is about 20 inches in length. About a third to a quarter of that length is made up of the tail. Very soft, wonderful fur on the body, and coarse bristles on the tail. And ladies and gentlemen, notice the spurs that he has on his back legs. They are connected by ducts to poison glands, the only example of venom in the entire mammal order. And during the breeding season, the poison is very virulent. Well, He's a ridiculous-looking creature. He eats half of his own weight daily in earthworms, and he also enjoys crayfish. When they sent a couple of them to the Bronx Zoo 18 months ago, it was a tremendous problem to have enough earthworms to keep them alive during the journey. Now he has a heavy, reptile-like body, but he moves through the water with the greatest of ease. And let's watch him now as he swims about in his tank, the very rare duck-billed platypus. He's got frogman appendages there on the front, those great bulbous eyes. His meal of a crayfish meal is going to be dropped in a moment. He's after the crayfish. He's got him. And I hate to say it, but his table manners are terrible. Look at the frogman appendages that he's got. Duck-billed platypus. EMU. And those of you who have wrestled with that word over the years, I'm sure will be glad to see at last just what it represents. Well, they're fairly similar to ostriches. They're found only in Australia. They move with the greatest of ease and speed across the country, and they have the most voracious appetite, and they're the most curious birds that you could imagine. I was minding my own business and was reading, "What bird is that?" when one of them looked over my shoulder, and I heard him say, "That's for the birds." I felt almost as if I'd stepped out of the pages of Alice in Wonderland. And if you think it's very pleasant to be minding your own business and to be reading about Australia when you have something like that moving in on you, you have another thought coming. But this is a land of remarkable fauna, and certainly among the most curious of them all are the emus. I had a loaf of bread that was hidden there. There was an answer to it, and you really couldn't blame them, since they're always hungry. And with that thought in mind, let us now have a short intermission before we continue on to the second half. Thank you very much.
Weather conditions and soil conditions change the characteristic of the oils, and then they must be carefully checked in the laboratory before they are sent to be made into perfume. The final person who does make the test is a man who is called the Great Nose, and he is the most highly paid person in the perfume industry, and it is behind his locked doors that the famous perfumes of France are created. He is also the one who decides whether the basic oil is satisfactory enough to be used in the making of the perfumes. And he will sit here for sometimes several weeks smelling strips of test paper before he decides to add another ingredient. And sometimes it will take a Great Nose 10 years of such experimenting before he comes up with a new perfume. And a good French perfume is a combination of 70 to 80 synthetic and natural ingredients. So ladies, please cherish your French perfume. But flowers are used for making just perfumes. And before we leave this area of France, we're going to visit the largest rose research company in the world, owned by the Mayon family. They grow about 100,000 rose bushes a year. Most of them are dug up and thrown away, and only a few rose bushes are kept to further their research. Two members of the Mayon family are inspecting a new rose which they have just created, which is called Suspense. The way they make their money at Mayon is from the flower wholesalers that pay for their patented rose shoots. And they are working on a very interesting product right at the present. They are trying to develop the blue rose. They have not succeeded yet, but they say it is only a matter of time. And as you see, the rose does have a purplish or lavender color, and they intend to pollinate this rose with other roses, and with each succeeding generation, the rose will become a deeper blue. And they say it is only a matter of time before we will eventually develop the blue rose. And at that time, they will then cross it with roses of other colors, and then you will be able to buy at your florist roses of every color in the rainbow. They are very carefully pollinated, and to keep stray pollen from reaching the pestles, they are covered with a wax paper bag. During the succeeding several weeks, the fruit or bulb grows. Inside, the seeds mature. They are then opened and replanted to bring us another generation closer to the blue rose. One member of the Mayon family was nice enough to open one of these bulbs prematurely so you could better see what is actually taking place. Normally, when it is open, the seeds are much darker than this, but you can see the various seeds within the bulb. These roses that we see before us now have no names. They are used strictly for research here at Mayon. Two roses on the same stem, both different colors. Now we are going to take a short intermission before we begin the second part of the flume.
There is a tremendous eagerness on the part of those people to learn. They want to know us better. They want to know more about us. But if we are consistently going to set between us and those people a barrier of so-called military security, if we're going to panic and get all shook up and say the common people can't meet the common people because the only way you can meet people is at a sword's point, then all I can say is we've lost the Cold War already. Well, those are my impressions. Have you got any questions? The question is, what was the real reason why they did not want our president to visit Japan? I would say, first and foremost, the majority of the people of Japan were perfectly willing to have the president come. The Socialist Party is the party that is the leading opposition against Prime Minister Kishi. And the socialists did not want him to come because they felt that his coming to celebrate the anniversary of this 100 years of favorable friendship between the United States and Japan was to underscore the Japan-U.S. Security Treaty and, in a sense, to add strength and prestige to the Kishi regime, which was advocating it. And so strictly for political reasons, internal political reasons, they didn't want Eisenhower there patting their opponent on the back. You see what I mean? From their point of view, with which we as Americans may disagree, from their point of view, the timing of the president's visit was unfortunate. Many of them were saying that if he had come at some other time, they would have welcomed him too. They have nothing against Mr. Eisenhower and nothing against the United States. But they have much against Mr. Kishi, and they didn't want anything to happen that would give any political fodder and support to Mr. Kishi. That was the reason why. And when at length the demonstrations became so large and so obviously communist-financed, Mr. Kishi himself felt that perhaps an unfortunate incident might occur. And if it had between the United States and Japan, which Kishi, who was a good friend of ours, did not want to happen, and I really believe now, and this is risky for me to prophesy about politics in another country that I don't know very much about, but on the basis of what many people told me, the Japanese people as a whole, the Japanese nation, is so embarrassed by the fact that the leader of a great nation could not come to Japan and be guaranteed safety that they feel they've lost face terribly throughout the Orient. They're embarrassed by it, and it may cost the Socialist Party more votes in the long run than it would have than what they would have lost if Mr. Eisenhower had come.
How could the opposition get this strong if the government couldn't control it?
Well, I really don't think that they were as strong, but I think that Kishi had gotten to the place where he was a prisoner within his own house. The demonstrators were going around and around the outside of his house. They were blockading the entrance to the Diet building. Parliamentary government was virtually at a standstill. And when it was impossible for him to make the normal program of the government operative, he felt, well, maybe the safest thing is for us reluctantly to ask the president not to come at this time. It's very difficult for us to understand when we don't live under that kind of a new form democracy, but it seemed perfectly reasonable to the Japanese. The question is, when was the group first organized? Do you refer to the Zengakuren, the student demonstrator group? I could not tell you the exact date at which it was first organized, but the opposition began to be felt immediately after May 20th, which was the date when Mr. Kishi summoned the majority party. Prior to that time, you see, what had happened was this. The Socialist Party tried to blockade the Diet building so that the Prime Minister himself and the members of the majority party couldn't get into their seats in the Diet. Mr. Kishi said this was paralyzing parliamentary government, that the only thing that he could do to establish law and order was to call in the police. He called in the police to empty the hall. Immediately, the socialists said, this is the police state. This is fascism. This is undemocratic. And then they began the series of demonstrations. We're running out of tape, so I got to sign off. Aloha, boys in Buffalo.
To a program chairman, when I speak to Andy now, I think it must be very reassuring to know that we have in our club men like Frank Butterworth. I know that everybody listened with rapt attention to what you said, Frank. We thank you for bringing us these vivid pictures, word pictures, of what you saw on your recent trip to the Orient. I think you've given us all much to think about. Your suggestion for what we can do about it by making contributions to our...